Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Happy hunting. That was one of the messages recently sent by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to Boston Police Sergeant Detective Gregory Gallagher. Gallagher was serving as the BPD's ICE Task Force officer, though he was stripped of that role on Friday after WBUR first reported on this story. The email, which also included a detainer or a request from ICE to hold an individual who would otherwise be free to go, is one of 800 pages of documents recently obtained by WBUR that paint a clearer picture of the relationship between ICE and Boston Police. WBUR's Shannon Dooling has been digging through those documents, and she joins us now. Shannon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Shannon, let's start with some context. Can you explain a little more about what these documents are and what your initial impressions are as you're looking through them?
Sure. So we filed a public records request 7 months ago looking for more information about a so-called joint ICE-BPD task force. This came up in a federal lawsuit that was filed here in Boston earlier this year. And what we received included email exchanges between the BPD's designated ICE task force officer, whom you mentioned, Sergeant Detective Gregory Gallagher, and a number of federal immigration officials. Now, some of this communication is about people who BPD have arrested on charges like shoplifting and trespassing, low-level misdemeanor charges. In one of the exchanges, an ICE officer asks Gallagher if he can get more info about a woman who has several Boston larceny charges against her. And the ICE officer suspects that this woman is a student visa overstay and wants the names of the woman's parents. And so the next day, Gallagher replies with a copy of a booking sheet and writes in the email that the names of the parents are on that booking sheet. And so that, I mean, that is one example of some of the communication that we came to see in these email exchanges.
I mentioned that Gallagher was removed from his task force position on Friday after you first reported on this. And we do know that Mayor Marty Walsh has said the story sparked a lot of questions. What else have you heard from the mayor's office, Shannon?
Right. Lots of questions. In fact, it's interesting because, you know, we were providing the mayor's office and BPD Commissioner William Gross with a lot of this information for the first time. They weren't familiar with these email exchanges that we had asked them about. They weren't familiar about a formal understanding that the BPD and ICE have on the record. And so we know that Walsh, over the weekend, did, in fact, like you said, strip Gallagher of some of these duties. We don't know at this point what his plan is other than to look into that relationship farther. Let's hear a little bit from Walsh about exactly his reaction to some of the news that that we broke on Friday.
We're going to take a look, evaluate that spot and the relationship to make sure the relationship that we intended to have is to make sure that we're watching, looking for serious criminals.
And so obviously that's the message that Walsh has been pretty adamant about since President Trump took office, and we've sort of heard more about fear in the immigrant community. Walsh has been really adamant about wanting this to be a safe city for immigrants.
As you say, he has been adamant. He's made a lot of comments on the record, Shannon. How does what you found compare to what he said in the past regarding Boston's immigration enforcement policies?
Right. I mean, that's really been my biggest takeaway from the communications that we came to review is that there really is this clear flow of information between BPD in the form of this conduit, Sergeant Gallagher, and federal immigration officials. And so, you know, what we're looking for at this point is what are the sort of next steps that that Walsh is going to take? It's interesting. Let's take a listen, actually, to some of an interview that we had with Walsh back in March when all of this news about the joint ICE-BPD task force was first coming into play. Let's hear from him from March.
You know, I made it perfectly clear, Boston Police Department officers, they're not ICE officials. Our job should not be enforcing immigration laws for the federal government. If they want to come in and enforce federal law, let them come in and enforce federal law. It's not our job.
But, Tiziana, within a month of Walsh telling us that BPD are not ICE officials, these same emails that we've been discussing were flowing back and forth between Gallagher and ICE.
So, Shannon, we've talked on this show before about the City's Trust Act, which basically prohibited Boston police from holding individuals solely at ICE's request. How does that fit into what you've been finding?
Right. So that original Trust Act, some cities refer to it as a sanctuary city policy, but in Boston it's called the Trust Act. That was passed unanimously by the city council in 2014. Walsh signed it right away. And it's an ordinance that essentially is supposed to outline guidance around how and when BPD should be interacting with ICE. And now the strength of that ordinance has come under a lot of fire this year. It came into question earlier when Gallagher was cited in that same federal lawsuit I mentioned at the top. He was involved in the ICE arrest of a man who at the time of his arrest was in the country without authorization. He filed a workers' comp claim, and his lawyers feared that his construction company retaliated against him. And so during a Boston City Council hearing in April, councilors Josh Zakim and Lydia Edwards, citing the details revealed in that Department of Labor lawsuit, questioned whether the city needed to revisit the teeth, if you will, that are established by the Trust Act, how strong it is. And in June, Walsh and Zakim filed new proposed language, but it hasn't gone up for a vote yet to the city council.
Shannon, what about other agencies around Massachusetts? Have you learned anything about their involvement with ICE from these emails and documents?
Yeah. Well, and looking through these 800 plus pages of records, we learned that these HSI ICE task force officers, again, these designated task force officers, are working throughout New England, though we don't know just yet to what extent each officer is working in their, you know, respective agencies. But according to the documents, there are at least 30 people with that designation. So they are local law enforcement who are trained and certified with federal customs officer authorizations. And on that list, we saw an MBTA transit officer listed as a task force officer. We also saw a sergeant from the Bristol County Sheriff's Office. Now, the Bristol County Sheriff did just get back to me right before I joined you, Tiziana, and told me that their assigned task force officer has been holding those duties as the ICE task force officer since 2013. We've never heard about this before until we took a look at these documents. And they, at Bristol County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, says he has no intention of stripping that task force officer of any of his federal duties and, of course, values the relationship that his employees have with ICE. But we're going to be asking a lot more questions about all those other positions as time goes on.
So, Shannon, this is a good chance to take a step back. I want to look at the bigger picture here. We just talked on Radio Boston on Friday about the dust-up at the Harvard Crimson, where some students were upset that the paper reached out to ICE for comment on a story about an anti-ICE protest, their concern being that the Crimson was calling ICE's attention to the protest and students involved, including at least one self-acclaimed dreamer. We also have an ongoing legal fight over ICE's practices of arresting immigrants at or around courthouses. Two Massachusetts district attorneys are plaintiffs against ICE in that suit. So does what you found add any fuel to the argument that ICE is using these kind of backdoor channels to enforce immigration laws?
Well, obviously, there is a lot going on in this sphere right now. A lot of conversations happening about the involvement of ICE in federal law, let alone local law enforcement. So I think I'd say what we've found shows an established pattern of communication between federal immigration officials and Boston PD, again, with Gallagher providing that clear conduit. We know that the existence of these emails and, in fact, the existence of the memorandum of understanding between the BPD and ICE, as I mentioned, that all came as a surprise to both the mayor and Boston PD Commissioner William Gross when we mentioned these details to both of them last week. And we know that much of the communication we've reviewed runs counter to the mayor's message that his public guidance on the relationship between BPD and ICE, whether it adds fuel to any fire about disagreements around ICE and the way the agencies cooperate, I think it certainly raises more questions. And we're going to be following this to see how local agencies react.
Okay, Shannon. And last question, very briefly: do we have any reason to believe that ICE has done anything illegal or outside its authority?
No, not based on my review of these documents anyway. I mean, they have, like I said, this agreement was on the books. And what's, you know, in question now is basically how this aligns with Walsh's guidance to BPD and the Trust Act.
That is WBUR Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We also have in studio WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. It's for another story, but I have to.
Oh,
I can't resist, because Judge Gertner, as you were listening to that, you shook your head like a dozen times. So let me just ask you.
Last time I come in studio for
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Do you have an initial reaction to this that you would like to share?
Well, there are rules with respect to the kind of information sharing that the federal government can oblige a state to do to help them in the enforcement of the immigration laws. The question is whether or not the Boston police are going beyond that, and it sounds like they are. And so then the question is, the going beyond part is up to Mayor Walsh to effect. He can certainly say to the Boston police, you have to do what you're obliged by law to do, which is, I think, to provide certain kinds of names of people who are, I think, involved in more violent offenses, but certainly not to be an investigative arm of ICE. And it's really up to him to stop that and shut that down.
See, this is why we have a legal analyst. We can ask these questions and catch her by surprise when we do so. All right, so let's shift gears to the story that you're actually here for. Mm-hmm. A former Boston College student is being indicted on a charge of involuntary manslaughter for her role in her boyfriend's suicide. Prosecutors say 21-year-old In Young Yu physically and psychologically abused her boyfriend, Alexander Ertula, over the course of their 18-month relationship. Here's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins speaking at a press conference earlier today.
We have a barrage of a complete and utter attack on this man's very will and conscience and psyche by an individual to the tune of 47,000 text messages in the 2 months leading up, and an awareness, we would argue, of his frail state at that point.
Now, Ertula jumped from the roof of a parking garage and died the morning of May 20th, the day he was set to graduate. D.A. Rollins says there are clear differences between this case and the high-profile manslaughter conviction of Michelle Carter, who the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found guilty of causing the death of her boyfriend, Conrad Roy. And I should note, Judge Gertner, you have been serving on Michelle Carter's defense team.
That's right.
As the case is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme
right.
Court.
Right.
So are you surprised by the D.A.'s decision to prosecute this case as involuntary manslaughter?
Yes, for a number of reasons. So, first of all, if there were instances of physical assault over the course of a year, that is an independent crime. The question is the link between the question, which is a troubling and complicated one, is the link between those assaults and those texts and his decision to jump off the roof. Suicide is a complicated psychological phenomenon. And one of the things that we grappled with in the Carter case was there's sort of a continuum of conduct here. On the one hand is the person who hands the potentially suicidal person the loaded gun. That's one end of the continuum. The other end of the continuum is the Carter case, where it was really just talk, and she was 50 miles away when he committed suicide. Even the handing of the loaded gun case is a complicated one, because suicide is a, quote, voluntary act. And the proof has to be that someone, that but for that event, the person would have not committed suicide. So there are lots of questions to ask, even in a situation, whereas here, the defendant is standing next to the young man who commits suicide. What are the questions?
So,
Did he try to commit suicide before?
Which we don't know at this point.
We don't know. That's right, because the best predictor of suicide is prior suicide attempts. I'm not impressed. I don't know enough about the numbers of text messages. Anyone who has teenagers knows that that doesn't seem to me to be an extraordinary amount.
So let me just clarify for our listeners. In the press conference today, D.A. Rollins noted that there were more than 70,000 texts between the deceased and the defendant over a two-month period, and that 47,000 approximately of those texts came from In Young You. That does come out to about 800 texts a day. That is a lot.
It is a lot, but I would want to look at it in context. Again, I can only you're looking at this through the lens of the Carter case. While the press only reported the texts that seemed to be encouraging suicide, there were also many that said, "Conrad, get help." And so the question is, what are these texts in context? But the bottom line here is that this is a fraught and complex area, and most states have chosen to deal with it through statutes. And the statutes say, here are the circumstances under which assisting another person's suicide is criminal.
And we don't have such a statute.
We don't have that.
We
basically shoehorn this into, you know, a common law 500-year-old involuntary manslaughter charge, which means then it's subject to whether to the prosecutor thinks that it qualifies as involuntary manslaughter. It becomes exactly what the criminal law shouldn't be, which is unpredictable.
So, Judge Gertner, to the layperson, I think one would think that there seems like a very big difference between assisted suicide and involuntary manslaughter around the concept of intent. So is it fair to put something like this in the assisted suicide continuum, given the wide variety of possible intent we could be talking about here?
Well, but assisted suicide means only that you have taken acts to facilitate someone else's suicide, where there are statutes, typically they say, you know, facilitating in terms of providing the instrumentality, the weapon. The statutes that have said encourage have been held unconstitutional.
So let's go back to this, the parallel with the Michelle Carter case, because Rollins actually made a distinction between this case and the Michelle Carter case at the press conference today.
There are similarities in that the culprit are both the girlfriends in those circumstances. But where I would distinguish, and I think the facts will show, in Carter there was very limited physical contact prior and some very egregious language in the moments leading up to the death. We have, quite frankly, I would say the opposite of that.
And of course, when she says the opposite of that, again, she talked about a pattern. She talked about a pattern of behavior in the 2 months prior to Urtula's suicide. Does proximity of activities or even the person in question at the time of someone's death matter from a legal
physical
standpoint?
Physical presence makes this case, the BC student case, a more complicated case. There's no question about it, because physical presence at the time of the suicide creates obligations to do something.
And In Young Yu was allegedly on the top of the parking structure at the time of the suicide.
Right. I'm less impressed by the text leading up to that, because as I said, I want to look at all of them. I'd want to understand what the full context would be. In the Michelle Carter case, what was most stunning is that while the press kept on talking about how she said, get back in the truck, encouraging him to commit suicide by a text, as it turns out, that was never shown to be a contemporaneous statement. It was a statement that was made by Carter 2 months after the suicide, describing what had gone on in a rambling email. So what is said here is really critical. But the bottom line is, suicide is complicated. don't do this through involuntary manslaughter, which has virtually no specific content. Do it through legislation that we can then address and tell people exactly what's wrong and right.
Let's step back and look at the domestic violence dimension of this, because as we know, D.A. Rollins specifically said that In Young Yoo used physical violence as well as psychological abuse in the months leading up to Ertula's suicide. She said something particularly interesting about domestic violence in her press conference today.
Domestic violence is not perpetrated by one type of abuser. A perpetrator is not limited by their gender or the gender of their partner. Domestic violence may not always look the same, but it is always about power and control.
So setting aside the Carter case entirely, could this particular case have any broader effect on how we deal with other domestic violence cases?
Well, it does, but you have to, again, look at what's interesting about this is if there were violence, if there was violence in the months leading up to the suicide, D.A. Rollins could prosecute this woman for that violence. The question here is linking what had gone on before the suicide with a suicide. That's the problem. Most domestic violence cases are cases in which you prosecute the person for having hit someone.
And physical
that's what
violence,
ought to be done here.
So physical violence is one piece. Psychological violence, historically in prosecutions, can one be prosecuted for psychological violence as well as physical violence?
It depends. I mean, it really depends on what the psychological violence is. It would be, it could be verbal harassment, I suppose, but that... That usually is prosecuted civilly through injunctions that sort of do not, you know, essentially to keep out injunctions. We reserve the criminal law for very specific things. And here the specific thing would be if she physically assaulted her boyfriend. That's the analogy, and that's what we do. Suicide has multiple causes, and that may be the step too far in this case.
Okay. So I want to talk now about the school for just a moment. Now, I was faculty at BC actually at the time of this suicide. I remember when it happened. It happened on BC commencement day. They were both BC students. Does the school have any legal concerns here?
The school has civil concerns, yes. The school has civil concerns to the extent that they knew about this kind of behavior. The school has...
Which we don't know.
That's right. The school has, you know, it's called parents patriae, which is school bears a relationship to students, which is the functional equivalent of parents. And so they have an obligation to keep their students safe. It's an obligation that inheres in the tuition payments and the contracts that a college has with its students to keep them safe. And so it seems to me they have affirmative obligations here, but they're civil obligations. They're not. Nobody is criminally liable under these circumstances.
Okay, that is WBUR legal analyst, retired federal judge, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. Or you can text the crisis line at 741-741. Stay with us. I'm Tisiana Deering. There's more ahead.